slow, and this is my impression of a politician. I believe in the people, and their cars, and Progressive, and the fact that you, yes, you can plug in Snapshot to save even more money for being a good driver. I also believe in Sasquatch, but more as a joke, but also kind of seriously.
Safe drivers save with Snapshot from Progressive.
I approve of this message, and Sasquatch, if you are real, you can totally be my running mate.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company. Snapshot not available in all states.
Blog Talk Radio.
Wellness, sports, politics, finances.
You are listening to the station for information and inspiration. AM 1240 WGBB.com and 1240 WGBB Freeport. We are WGBB, the station that serves your community.
The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Welcome to Sports Radio New York, a network of New York sports talk shows heard on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB. Check out New York Hockey Talk with Rob Cole.
Old-time hockey.
New York Baseball Digest with Mike Silva. Baseball Talk with Carl the Cabby and Dugout Joe. Sports Talk Live with Frankie the Sports Guy. The Starting Nine with Steve Rogan, Paul Revelant, and Alex Goldfinger. The Dog Pound with Moose and Doc. And Sports Talk 1240 with Anthony Donahue. Listen every Sunday night at 9 p.m. on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB. And check out all past shows online at sportsradiony.com. The following program is brought to you by Sports Radio New York. From the studios of 1240 AM WGBB, welcome to New York Baseball Digest with Mike Silva.
Welcome to NYBD on WGBB this Sunday, August the 16th. Of course, you could be part of the show 24/7, 365 at my radio show blog, nybaseballdigest.com. Well, welcome in everybody. Cast of thousands in the studios of 1240 AM WGBB. If you're wondering what happened to the Weekly Digest podcast, well, Howard is on vacation, our buddy Howard McDell of SNY. So we gave him off, you know, today. Guy works hard. He does the tour for the Baseball Talmud and, you know, does writing for the site and, of course, the Weekly Digest. So he's taken off, so you're going to have to just deal with me here on WGBB. But it's a great show. Now, not only do we have our buddy Joe Gucciardo, he's got the little camera set up, so you'll be able to see my mug in a couple of days for those that listen to this on replay. We got our buddy, the intern, Anthony, over here. He's been doing some great work. He'll be popping up any numbers or any kind of information we need. And we also have an in-studio guest and a headline guest. First, for those that have been going to the website, Victor Rojas of the MLB Network will be joining us in the back half of the show. Now, Victor is not going to be live. I had a chance to catch up with him earlier in the week. For those who may not be familiar, Victor is the son of Cookie Rojas, who was an infielder back in the 70s, mainly with Kansas City. So we're going to talk about growing up in a baseball family, a little bit about his dad, who also was a coach with the Mets under Bobby Valentine and was part of that 2000 Subway Series team. And Victor, for those that are not familiar, played ball in college and in the pros. He also has held a number of positions, from general manager for the Newark Bears. He's also been in broadcasting, obviously, working for the MLB Network right now. Tons of stuff going on with Victor Rojas. So he's going to join us and talk about, you know, obviously, not only what he's doing with the MLB Network, but some of the memories he has in baseball. And I think it's going to be a really fun segment. But let me get to our first guest. And, you know, he's going to be joining me here live in studio. I think this might be, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't include our buddy Adam behind the glass, our producer Adam. But Adam, I believe this is our first in-studio guest here. It's Mark Costello. Now, I believe many Yankee fans are aware of this project, Mark's project already. I mean, Mark has, and his group have been in the Daily News, on River Avenue Blues, on WCBS 880. But the website is SaveTheYankeeGate2.com, and essentially Mark is looking to preserve not all of Yankee Stadium, but just Gate 2, and that's the, I guess you would say, the main gate that you'd be walking into for those who have gone to Yankee Stadium numerous times. So he's going to be joining us in studio. I have him sitting right next to me. Talk a little bit about the project, how it came about. We'll chat about the different types of, proposals that have gone out there. There's three, and, I'm learning right along with the listeners. So, but anyway, let's kick it off, and let me welcome him in. It's Mark Costello of Save the Yankee Gate 2 to the show. Mark, pleasure to talk to you. How you doing?
Very good, Mike, and thank you very much for having me on the show, and I'm looking forward to spending the next half hour to chatting about the Gate 2 project.
And definitely, when the first time I heard about this was back in June. I believe the Yankees were playing Seattle, and I read about it in the Daily News, and I'm like, wow, there were always people when Shea Stadium was being demolished talk about, oh, save Shea, but look, I'm a Mets fan. I'm not a Yankees fan. I had memories of Shea. It was time to move on. And all throughout the winter, nothing was being said or done about Yankee Stadium. It was, the new one was going up. The old one was still there. Last year, and I think I told you this before the show began, Linda Ruth Tassetti, Babe Ruth's granddaughter, talked about not only retiring Babe's number, but talked about, doing something there to preserve the house that Ruth built, or the ground. And
sure.
And recently, and the demolition of Yankee Stadium website has been great. You started to see them rip stuff down, the field, and then reality set in. And that's when I came across what you guys are doing. So let's start out, for those who may not be familiar, talk about exactly what your group and what you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Really what we're trying to do is Gate 2 is actually one of the three major gates of the old Yankee Stadium. It's actually located in the left field corner of the old stadium. And the reason why we picked Gate 2 as a preservation project is that it's really located in a good spot. It's on 161st Street, right across the street from the new Yankee Stadium. In fact, Gate 6, which is in the right field corner of new Yankee Stadium, would faces Gate 2 in old Yankee Stadium. So the juxtaposition between the two gates is really interesting. The bridge from old to new is I think one of the phrases we use in our website. Maybe we'll get into the different proposals and how they evolved over the years. But one of the major concerns of the community is that the park area. The old Yankee Stadium is going to be redeveloped as parkland, and basically three baseball fields are going to be built there. So the community was very concerned because they lost the Mackam Stand Park, where the new stadium now sits, and there was a deal had been made when the new stadium was being conceived, and it was basically a park swap. So in other words, the old park, Mackam Stand Park, was going to be replaced with Yankee Stadium, but then the old Yankee Stadium was going to be turned into some parks, and the amount of acreage was supposed to equal equal. So what happened was, when the neighborhood found out that some of the parkland was going to be located on top of parking garages and down by the river, there was a lot of controversy about that. So, and I'll back up a minute. The original proposal for the old stadium was that they were going to retain a pretty good portion of the original stadium, basically the lower bowl between first and third bases.
And that's what I remember.
Exactly. In fact, when the new stadium was announced, which I think was in late 2005, and everybody asked, well, what's to become of old Yankee Stadium? Well, that was what was announced. So because of the neighborhood opposition and the need for the parkland, additional parkland that's closer to the neighborhood, they decided, well, we're not going to be able to keep any of Yankee Stadium. It's all going to go. And instead of one baseball field on the site of the old original field, they decided to put three new fields in. And therefore, the old stadium really had to go in as far as what the current plan now is. So that's where we came along. When the word got out, pretty belatedly, that the old stadium was not going to be retained at all. That's when people started emailing each other. And the group that I'm with is basically kind of evolved through a baseball website called Baseball Fever. And a lot of us who are baseball fans, know it's a pretty interesting website. And they have all different, what they call threads. They're basically topics. And there's a bunch of topics about the Yankees, Yankee Stadium, the Mets, and demolition of Yankee Stadium, demolition of Shea Stadium. It's all pretty interesting. So on the Yankee Stadium demolition thread, a lot of us really just started feeding off each other. What can be saved? It's a shame that the original stadium, so much history there, was going to be completely demolished. And so this Gate 2 project or a proposal that we have evolved because we knew we had to be realistic. We knew that most of the stadium was not, it just was not going to be preserved due to the overall situation. So we thought, well, this is a realistic way to go about it. We have Gate 2. It's a very architecturally interesting gate. In fact, it's probably the coolest section of the original stadium. And when I say original stadium, the original 1920s era stadium, before the renovations in the 1970s. Stadium, as most old Yankee fans know, the stadium was very extensively renovated between 1973 and 1976. And Gate 2 has a lot of the elements of the original 1920s Yankee Stadium. So we thought from that standpoint, from a historical standpoint, it was very worthy of salvaging. And its location is perfect because it's right along East 161st Street, where it really would not take up any parkland.
Sure.
So that's the rub.
Yeah, I mean, and when you, if I'm not mistaken, Gate 2, anytime you see an old photo of Yankee Stadium, that's what you're looking at, right? The most of the time is that Gate 2?
It's either Gate 2, Gate 6, or Gate 4. Gate 2 is the one we're talking about, is in left field. Gate 4 is the home, is the home plate entrance, and then Gate 6 is the right field entrance. Now, Gates, reason why we're not talking about Gate 4 and Gate 6 in this context is, number one, their location really wouldn't facilitate what we think is realistic and not impinging on the future park, which they're going to call Heritage Field, by the way. But Gate 2 is better located. Also, Gates 4 and 6 were extensively remodeled during the 1970s renovation. There's really not much left of the original two gates. So that's why we're focusing on Gate 2. So, in fact, you mentioned is Gate 2 is what's often shown. Often it is. If you see a picture of the original stadium, you're more likely to see Gate 4, which is the home plate section. But now, if they want to show an older-looking section of Yankee Stadium, they will show Gate 2. In fact, the logo for last year, the final year at Yankee Stadium in 2008, was a kind of a stylized version of Gate 2.
Yeah. Well, you're not alone in all this. You've been kind enough to invite Richard Lillard, who's joining us on the line right now. He's also involved with SaveTheYankeeGate2.com. Richard, Mike Silva here, NY Baseball Digest on WGBB. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing, sir?
Great. I guess I'll get you in on the dialogue here. Mark has been outlining pretty much how you guys started and the first proposal. Give us some of your thoughts on the project and how you've been how's it been going for you so far?
It's certainly been an interesting ride so far. I live out in Phoenix, Arizona, and I've been a Yankee fan, pretty much since I started liking baseball. I started with, being a fan of the Babe, and it was like reading about this guy who could hit all these home runs and everything, and, who wouldn't love that? And then, I got sucked into the whole Yankees lore and everything like that, and I've just been a fan ever since. And, when we started talking about this online, we started talking about making it serious, and I think it was Mark who, he said, email me for details, and then we'll start doing this. And, once we started talking, it just kind of snowballed from there. And it's been a really great ride, but, it's definitely been enlightening as well. To try and get the point across to so many people that it's not going to take up any parkland or anything like that, and that it does make sense, and that it would be a noble monument to what once stood there and all this history that happened there. It's been a very daunting task.
And you look, Phoenix, Arizona, that's quite a bit away. I mean, for you to take action on this, you know, that's a lot of time from a distance. And, I mean, it shows, I guess, how passionate you are about this, I would think.
I certainly hope so. You know, I'm still in college and everything and trying to juggle, you know, college, full-time college things.
ASU?
You know, yes.
I would think so.
Yeah, and trying to juggle all of that with, you know, conference calls that we've been doing and sending out emails. And, you know, sometimes I'll check my email at night if I haven't had a full day and there's, you know, 16, 17 things in there. And we've got all these orders of business that we have to take care of.
Yeah.
It's definitely insane sometimes.
Yeah. So, now, Mark, you talked about the initial plan. Now, the initial plan, it's not just changing, you know, there's been a couple of different, there's a current proposal, there was a second one. How did, now get to the second one and how we got to now a third proposal here, because this gets kind of complicated. You're dealing with not only Yankees here, but you're dealing with the city of New York, and I think there's a lot of different dynamics going on here that are more than just you and Richard and a group of people trying to convince the Yankees.
Yeah, absolutely. What it is, in terms of the ownership, Yankee Stadium is owned by the city of New York and has been for some number of years. In fact, I think the city bought the stadium in about 1971 in preparation to the original renovation. So the city remains the owner of the stadium, and they've charged the New York City Department of Parks and Recreation with redeveloping the site. That's after the demolition, which has already begun, gets completed. So, in fact, I think the demolition is supposed to be completed by the summer of next year, 2010. And then the New York City Department of Parks is going to come in with their contractors and develop Heritage Field. So in terms of the different proposals, as I mentioned before, the original proposal for retaining part of the stadium was changed because of the situation with the park swap and the number of acres, like I explained before. So then the current plan was adopted, which is basically tearing down the whole stadium. And they have had, they've made some adjustments over the past few months because people have made similar points as we have. And what they plan to do at this point is to retain two sections of the frieze or the facade. It's more commonly called a facade. That's the scalloped section that used to surround the old stadium from around the in the upper structure, and then after the renovation in the 70s, they put it out over center field. So those concrete sections of the frieze, two sections are going to be placed behind one of the new fields in the new Heritage Field, and also the big bat, which was built in the 1970s, is going to be retained as well. So that's the current proposal. Our group thinks that this gate two, in fact, you know, I've had a number of meetings with the Parks Department, where we've met together at common meetings, you know, other meetings with others, and I've said to the Parks Department, you know, that you've got a very good plan. If you just add one more thing, you know, just kind of making a little light of it, but
sure.
The problem with the current plan is that it doesn't retain anything from the original Yankee Stadium. As I said before, the gate two is really a good, tangible, and recognizable piece of the old stadium.
And I think it would be cool if I were to go and play ball on one of these fields to be able to bring my son or my daughter or my friend and just see part of history. And I look here on you gave me a nice little packet, and I find it interesting. You mentioned Forbes Field and some of the things that in Pittsburgh and Cleveland and stuff like that. Now, the reason I bring up Forbes Field is Ralph Kiner was on the telecast today with the Mets.
Great.
And he talks about how home plate is like in the University of Pittsburgh. I think it was like an administrative office. And I'm like, wow. I mean, you're now, you know, having an administrative office. Ebbets Field is a housing project.
Right.
I mean, great. You cannot preserve every historic building. This is Yankee Stadium. There's a certain amount of, I guess the word panache or whatever you want to call it. I'm really surprised, and I understand the political part, and I understand the community, and you can't leave both stadiums up. It would be excess, especially with what you have across the street.
Absolutely.
But I'm really surprised. I mean, are you getting a cold shoulder? Are you getting... and Richard, I have a question for you. Just give me 1 minute here. I just wanted to follow up with Mark. Are you getting a cold shoulder or some kind of... you know, what's the reaction? Are they ignoring you? Are they... patronizing you? I mean, what do you feel the response has been?
Well, the Parks Department, who we've, like I said, we've had some contact with, they've argued against our proposal because, I could put myself in their shoes. You know, we're asking them to change a current plan. It's just we believe, you know, this is just too important to let go. You did mention the polo grounds in Ebbets Field. And those of us who are older or even younger in our baseball fans and historians, you know, a lot of us just—and you'll see book after book and TV special after TV special about the polo grounds in Ebbets Field. And they are gone. They're gone without a trace. And there's nothing but a plaque or two, you know, at those housing projects left over. And what we're trying to do is to avoid that. I've said on previous shows that, you know, if this happens, if Yankee Stadium is completely eradicated, you know, it's not going to take long for us to regret that. I mean, we really have a chance to do a eminently doable project here. You know, just don't tear it down.
Yeah. Now, Richard, you're on the internet. You're obviously, like I said, you're out in Phoenix. This is an organic type of grassroots campaign that you guys are doing. Talk about the response and getting the word out. Obviously, you're on a show like mine, but you've been on bigger venues like the Daily News and WCBS 880. And talk about what the response has been, in your opinion, to what you guys are doing, from the fans, I guess, specifically.
The fans have always said, the same, pretty much all of them, you know, 95 to 99% of the people who apply on our website or who talked to us in public when they saw us. We did a big event up at June 30th. I actually flew out to New York, and we were outside of Gate 2 trying to pass out flyers and shirts and things. And, you know, overwhelmingly, you know, the amount of people that talk to us about it, it's all positive. They say, you know, this is a great idea. It makes so much sense. Why won't they do it? And, you know, our grassroots campaign, you know, as it's been called several times, is kind of taking a bit of a turn now at this point, to where we're trying to actually just try and get the word out. And, well, you know, while that's always been the case, but now we're trying to also educate, because we found that the firmest opposition that we come up against is, you know, people who sit there and say, well, the stadium was changed so much in the 70s, so why should they bother to save any of it now? And, you know, we've just kind of calmly and politely tried to explain to people it's still the same stadium. You know, there's only about the upper 30 feet of that wall is actually from the 70s. The rest of it has been there since the 20s. It's been there since Babe Ruth played baseball there. It's, you know, it's a piece of Bronx history. It's a piece of American history, and it's a piece of baseball history. So that's been, you know, it's been overwhelmingly positive, but at the same time, those who sit there and say no, or sit there and say that it's a bad idea, are 9 times out of 10, they are the ones who sit there and they're just misinformed. You know, they're under the pretense that the stadium is not original to 1923 or 1928, and they just don't, you know, they don't know that this is actually the original piece that we're trying to save.
Richard, I'm assuming you went to the new Yankee Stadium when you flew to New York and watched the game. Am I correct in assuming
yes.
that? What did you think? I mean, I got to be honest, I haven't covered a game at Yankee Stadium, and I haven't been there as a fan. I had an opportunity a couple of times, and it just didn't work out. I've talked to a number of people. They like a lot of aspects of it. There was a lot of criticism earlier in the year about fan noise and the moat and all that stuff. But I kind of feel that, especially after the Red Sox series, it's starting to feel like home. I'm curious, what was your impression and what are your thoughts on the new stadium?
Well, I had never actually been to a game in the old stadium. I wasn't fortunate enough to have caught that, but my girlfriend was kind enough to actually fly me out back in November to see the old stadium one time before it was closed off and the public was no longer allowed indoors. And by comparing it to the new stadium, just seeing it empty, because when we walked in on June 30th, there was a huge rain delay. There were not a lot of people in the stands or anything like that. I got to say, it was very impressive. You know, it was definitely a very very impressive, very towering structure. Was it the same as standing, you know, just at the edge of a tunnel at the old stadium and looking up and seeing the bottom of the upper deck directly above you? Not necessarily, and I'm kind of left to take it to my imagination as to what it was like to see a game in the old stadium. But I could say, you know, they did do a very fine job at not recreating, but giving an interpretation of what sits across the street. And, you know, they did do a great job on that, but I think that it would be an even better job if they had something to compare it to as a tangible monument.
And, Mark, I'm watching you. It sounds like you echo the sentiments of Richard on what he thinks of the new stadium.
Yeah, I've been to the new stadium. In fact, I was there on opening day on April 16th, and I've been there probably seven or eight times since. Was there with Richard on June 30th. It's a beautiful stadium, and it has some really nice elements. If I could get back to a quick aside about the response,
mm-hmm.
We and what we're really trying to do going forward, we've had a number of meetings with the community. The Bronx Board Number 4 is located in the Bronx, and we had a meeting with them, and that's the first time where I actually met the Parks Department and saw their current proposal. And a lot of the people in the Bronx Community Board were very favorable towards our proposal. And another event that happened in May was I testified at a thing called the New York City Design Commission. And what they do is they approve or really review all different public type jobs, whether it's parks or streets or even artwork, you know, that's being restored. And the Parks Department attempted to get the approval from this community, or I should say this design board, for their current plan, and they gave a presentation on what their current plan is. And so I was given 3 minutes to give our proposal for Gate 2. And
that's a tough 3 minutes.
It really was, to get it all in. We're talking for a half hour here, and we can go on for another hour.
Sure.
You got to move on. But a lot of what I was going to say, though, is a lot of the commissioners were very favorable towards our idea. In fact, what the result of that meeting was that they basically charged the Parks Department with coming back with they gave them tentative approval, but they had to come back with a revised proposal that better captured the history of Yankee Stadium. So that meeting, that revised proposal is
we don't know what it is yet. Is that what you're saying?
We don't. We've heard some. We've heard some ideas.
You have the third one, but yeah. This is kind of TBD type of deal.
Exactly. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to come up with some way of better capturing the history of Yankee Stadium. And at this point, reportedly, without saving Gate 2. So we're still plugging away on trying to, as Richard said, educate as many people as we can. We also were offered a meeting with the Bronx Borough President, Ruben Diaz, and we're in the process of having that meeting arranged. They've offered to meet with us, but we haven't scheduled a date yet. But that will be upcoming as well. So we're trying to work our way through the politicians and ultimately get the get the ear of, as a former president used to say, the deciders.
Yeah, hands off. Are the Yankees hands off on this?
Yeah, the Yankees haven't responded, and
they're okay with you. Obviously, they can't stop you from being outside the stadium, but they haven't intimidated you or made you feel uncomfortable.
No, not at all. And we've made the point. Both Richard and I agree that the new stadium is very nice. We're not anti-Yankee. We basically start off as Yankee fans that are also history buffs,
sure.
And so it's kind of a we really have a kind of a dual purpose here, really, to save Yankee history, but also save New York City. And I don't want to get too melodramatic about it, but it's almost world history.
Sure.
With all the popes and that have visited the stadium.
Football, New York Giants,
all that. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it definitely is. Hey, Richard, I'm going to wrap up here. I'm going to give you a final word, and then I'll have Mark chime in. Give us some of your final thoughts for those listening. What is the last point or two you want those that are listening to tonight's show, either live or on replay, to understand about what you guys are trying to do?
The biggest thing that I've always wanted people to understand from the beginning is this is not any type of a corporate cause or anything like that. This is something that we want to do simply to preserve history. It's not something that's intrusive to the Bronx community. It's not something that would be intrusive to Turner Construction, actually, who's doing the demolition. They would just have to go around the gate, preserve it, leave it when they tore down the rest of the stadium, preserve it. It would stand as a testament to the time and to Bronx, American, and world history.
Yeah, interesting.
There's been so much there.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you. And Mark, I'm assuming you echo that. I mean, what about, you know, piggybacking on that? Anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, Richard just put up the idea of the preserving, you know, working around the, in terms of the demolition. Richard and I actually spoke to some structural engineers, and we got some cost estimates, and the relative cost is pretty minimal compared to the amount of money that's being spent for the demolition itself, let alone the park itself. And most of what would remain in terms of a restored gate 2 is already there, as Richard said. It's probably 90% there. It would just be some minimal shoring up. It's really winnable. It's doable, and I was going to say it's really a win-win, we believe, for everybody involved.
You got any odds? You think this is going to happen 50-50, 40-60? I mean, would it be fair to even do that?
It's tough. It's the type of thing you'll never know if you won until you win.
Yep.
It's the type of thing where you know, we do have some time, you know, because it appears as though the demolition is going to proceed clockwise from the bleachers. So gate 2 conceivably could be last online in terms of that. And also they're going to work from inside out in terms of the demo. So we do have time. I think it's just a matter of getting into discussions with people who really want to make this happen. And that's what we're trying to do.
Well, listen, Richard, thank you for calling in here. Mark, thank you for stopping in. It's SaveTheYankeeGate2.com. Is there any number or anything? Just go to the website. Is that fair enough for those listening?
Yeah, www.SaveTheYankeeGate2.com. And we do have the as Mike has laid out the different proposals, the history of the whole thing. We've got basically a guest book, and we've gotten hundreds of comments, universally positive, on the guest book. And we've got some articles that we've and also podcasts, and we'll put this one on there as well.
I appreciate it. And we have a link on our site already. Well, guys, thanks a lot. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, Victor Rojas of the MLB Network will be back.
If you're trying to quit smoking, dipping, or chewing tobacco, you don't have to do it alone. Nicotine Anonymous is a 12-step program of recovery that meets regularly in your area. There are no dues or fees. The only requirement for membership is a desire to be free of nicotine. For information and meetings near you, call 877-TRY-NIC-A. That's 877-TRY-NICA, or visit nicotine-anonymous.org. Let us share our experience, strength, and hope with you.
So you're looking for a great club but don't want to go into Manhattan, or you'd like to find a new restaurant to check out, or you're buying a house here on Long Island and you'd like to find out about a certain area. Wouldn't it be nice if you could find out all the information in just one spot? Well, you can. LongIslandExchange.com. It's all you need to find out all about Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com for hotspots, classifieds, news, and more. LongIslandExchange.com is designed with only the Long Islander in mind. Get the best of Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com. Discover Long Island all over again at Long Island Exchange.
Making simple changes in your everyday travel choices makes a big difference to New York's air quality. Trip chain, use mass transit, rideshare, bike, or walk. Visit cleanairny.org to learn more. Clean Air New York, breathe it in. A public service message brought to you by the New York State Department of Transportation.
Sports Radio New York, a network of New York sports talk shows heard on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB. Check out New York Hockey Talk with Rob Cole.
Old-time hockey.
New York Baseball Digest with Mike Silva. Baseball Talk with Carl the Cabbie and Dugout Joe. Sports Talk Live with Frankie the Sports Guy. The Starting Nine with Steve Rogan, Paul Revelant, and Alex Goldfinger. The Dog Pound with Moose and Doc. And Sports Talk 1240 with Anthony Donahue. Listen every Sunday night at 9 p.m. on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB. And check out all past shows online at sportsradiony.com.
I have with me Victor Rojas of the MLB Network, and he's going to be talking some baseball with us. Victor, pleasure to speak to you. How are you today?
I'm doing all right. How are you, Mike?
Not bad. You know, you've been embracing the social networking with Twitter and the MLB blogs, and I was reading a post that you put up last week about your trip to Cooperstown, and it was actually very interesting. You know, you shared about how you were talking with Joe Gordon's daughter, and you know, it's just dad to her, and your dad is Cookie Rojas, and you grew up around the Kansas City Royals in the 70s, and I thought it was interesting, you know, with all the great players around you as a young kid, you never really realized how the enormity, I guess, of being a professional baseball player. You know, fans don't always think about that.
Yeah, the thing of it was is that when, as a kid growing up, you know, George Brett to me was just like an older brother. I had no idea who these people were growing up. They were just players and friends of my dad that we would go out and barbecue with after a game or after a Sunday game. And, you know, the magnitude, obviously the baseball, the business side has changed. And the advent of the internet and newspapers and all that stuff obviously has gotten a lot larger over the last 30 years compared to that of 1977 when my dad retired. So, you know, my dad still in the offseason had to go on sell insurance or go run his he had a shoe store in Overland Park, Kansas. So to me, baseball is just kind of, yeah, that's just a job. It wasn't like, oh my gosh, this guy is a professional baseball player. This is unbelievable. And I never had that mindset. So it was cool in the sense that I got to go to the ballpark. That is the only thing that I thought was really cool, that I got to go to the yard and work out early. But other than that, I never thought that my dad was like this famous big name guy. I just thought he was just my dad, you know, it was no big deal.
Yeah, and those, I had Brian McCray on last year, and it's funny, you and McCray now on radio, and the both of you grew up around those 70s teams, but I told Brian, I said, you know, that's one of the best runner-up teams, maybe this is saying a lot, but in baseball history, that was some team, and they never won a title.
Yeah, I mean, the closest one, of course, is the dagger in the heart, Mark Lytle pitching to Chris Chambliss, and you know, there were some unbelievable talented teams in Kansas City back in those days. But you know what? Oakland had a bunch of talented teams. The New York Yankees, of course, were extremely talented. But it was fun watching. I think that to me was the heartbreak. That, you know, my dad announced his retirement about mid-season. They had a Cookie Rojas Day in Kansas City, and it was his last go around in 1977. And you know, to see things play out the way they did, it was very difficult. You know, for him, because he had never experienced the World Series, and that to me is probably the best memory I have of him in baseball was 2000, when the New York Mets got to the World Series to face the New York Yankees, and having gone to all those playoff games in 98, 99, and the grind, all of a sudden 2000 happens, and boom, it's the first opportunity in my dad's professional career to experience a World Series. And I'll give you a quick little note on that. We were going downstairs as the celebration was going on in the field. And at Old Shea Stadium, there's when you come down the elevator, when you made a right down the tunnel, you had to go past the clubhouse. Now, there was this tunnel that led from the hallway down to the dugout. There was the hallway and then the clubhouse entrance. You had to get through that to go to the family room, and that's where we were going to wait. And as we came down the elevator and made that right down the tunnel to go down to the family room, at the exact same time as we got to that little tunnel passage between the field tunnel and to the clubhouse, my dad was walking off and met us all there. It was me and my brothers and my mom. And it was just, it couldn't have been a more perfect moment for a guy celebrating his first opportunity to go to a World Series and experience that. That all of a sudden, there's his family right at the turn right there as he was coming to the clubhouse. Those little moments right there, you can't pay for those moments, and those are the things that I cherish the most.
And I told you this off air. I still remember your dad getting kicked out the year before against Arizona, and then Bobby Valentine taking over third base. I mean, that was a weird day. I mean, Pratt hits the home run, but I mean, I don't remember another third base coach getting kicked out of a playoff game. I wonder if that's a record.
Hey, a couple of stories on that end right there. I will tell you this, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart. We were in the hotel that morning, and we heard the news that Mike Piazza was not going to be in that lineup that day, that Todd Pratt was getting the start. My wife, at that time, we'd been married 4 or 5 months or whatever, she said, Todd Pratt is going to be the hero today.
Wow.
She said that. Well, I mean, God's honest truth. The other thing is about my dad bumping my dad shoving Charlie Williams in that argument down the left field line. My dad had some serious high blood pressure problems. All season long, he was on medication. Like that play occurs, and it turns out that Charlie Williams had the right call. My dad took exception to the bumping that he got from Charlie Williams. That's why he gave him that little forearm shiver, and that's what upset him. But when he was going off on Charlie Williams, I've never seen him that upset on the baseball field. And my biggest concern, and my mom's biggest concern, is like he's going to blow a gasket.
Sure.
And all of a sudden, he's going to have to be carried off the field. But that being said. And it's why to this day my dad absolutely loved working for the New York Mets and the Mets fans in particular. That place, 55,000 people, because he was down the left field line, had to make that long walk back to that first base dugout after being ejected. The way they stood up and cheered for him is something that it was very moving at that time, because it showed to me the passion that New York fans have for their guys. And at that point, I realized that my dad was one of their guys. And it sucked that he got taken out of the game, that he got ejected and suspended. I believe it was for 7 games. I had to call Leonard Coleman and plead for him to be able to partake in the next series. I believe it was against the Atlanta Braves where they held my dad's jersey up in the dugout. For him to at least go out and be introduced, you know, on the foul line, because he wanted to be a part of that whole process. And it was amazing that day in at Shea Stadium, that's for sure.
And, you know, you talk about your dad. I mean, look, you've had many roles in baseball. You played college ball. You were in the minors. You worked for Upper Deck on the business side. I know you were on the Marlins coaching staff, play-by-play. Now you're an analyst. I mean, growing up around baseball, obviously that gives you kind of an idea of, okay, what the game is about. But, you know, that's a pretty impressive and diverse career. I mean, have you always wanted to be in baseball because of your dad or because you played the game?
I just thought it was the natural progression for me. I love the game. And I could, now that I have a 3-year-old son who is just, I mean, completely in love with baseball, I know what it was like to be me as a little kid. And, you know, he's absorbed by it, as was I. And the one thing, you know, my dad never pushed it on us. You know, he had 4 boys, and he never once said, you know, you're going to play baseball, or you need to do that. You know, he basically said, experience whatever you want to experience. I'll be behind you. He wasn't a big fan of football, but he still let me do it just so I can experience it, and I had fun with it. But that's just the way I grew up. He wanted us to be able to absorb everything, all of our surroundings, and every opportunity that presented itself. And that's kind of how I, you know, embraced life. And I was fortunate enough to be halfway decent to go to college and have it paid for to play baseball. And Billy Bavese signed me with the Angels, and I had a chance to experience minor league baseball. You know, the reality of it is, I believe I pissed away my baseball career. I didn't understand the work ethic. I didn't buy into the work ethic and having to grind it out on a daily basis. I just figured, you know, talent alone would be good enough. And, you know, I didn't have the right mindset at that time. And I still believe that the abilities that I possessed, I at least would have given myself an opportunity to get to the higher levels of the minor leagues, if not given a chance to pitch in the big leagues as a closer. But that being said, I never took it for granted. Or I did take it for granted, but when I walked away, I never took that decision for granted. I figured, you know what, it wasn't the right time for me. I moved on, and I thought the normal process for me was to work in baseball, and the baseball jobs are tough to come by.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you talk about your career. You were actually a pitcher and a catcher, right, in college, and then you pitched 1 year in Anaheim, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right, and I ended up going back. I was part of that Marlins staff you mentioned. I went back, and I became a player coach for Allen Ashby in the Texas-Louisiana League in their inaugural season in 94, and you ended up playing more than coaching because of injuries and limited roster and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, I was one of those guys. I was a shortstop in high school that could, you know, had a great arm, and it was just one of those things that you ended up playing wherever coach told you could play, and you weren't great to where you stood out in one position, but you weren't bad enough where you hurt the team in those other positions, and that's just how I was used, and I embraced that role, and that's kind of how I embraced my life in the business world. You know, I figured I could do anything as long as I'm up to the challenge and I put my mind to it. I can accomplish anything. And I worked for Nike Town Stores when they opened one up out in Southern California. That led to working in boxing for Roy Engelbrecht, who is now working for Golden Boy Productions. I think he's the CEO of Golden Boy Promotions there. He was also on the board of the Rancho Cucamonga Quakes. So that led me to minor league baseball. So it's like, everything I've done, it's just kind of been all intertwined, and end up working in hockey and arena football. It's just been a mishmash of things for me in the front office, and I took that experience and figured, you know what, I think I've done enough to where I could try to do something more and become more of myself, and I took some time off. I didn't know what I wanted to do in 1999, towards the end of 99, and it was that off season when my dad kept saying, you know what, man, you're 30, 31 years of age. Give it a go. See what you can do broadcasting-wise. And, you know, I got the job in Newark, and that led to MLB.com, and that led to the Arizona Diamondbacks. And, you know, 2 years in the minor league baseball, and all of a sudden, 8 years later, here I am on MLB Network. These last 9 years have just been a whirlwind for me, but it's been the funnest ride that I've ever been on in my life.
And, you know, you talk about all those positions. I mean, people think, and, okay, Victor Rojas, son of Cookie Rojas, manager, coach with the Mets, he's got to have advantages. I mean, you just kind of outlined, they don't care what your last name is. If you can't pitch, you're not going to make it. And if you can't announce, you're not going to make it. You know, you really had to see a lot of different sides of the game to come to where you're at. I think that's a big takeaway from what you've, you know, been talking about here.
I tell you what, I go back to my high school guidance counselor, and we talked about these things, about my last name, and all, you know, even in college, my middle name was son of Cookie Rojas. I mean, it was Victor Rojas, son of, and at that time, it was manager of the California Angels. That's when he was managing the Angels out there. So, and I was going to school in Southern California, so I had no chance. That's how I always was going to be measured. But my guidance counselor in high school, she said, don't worry about the last name. The last name is going to open doors for you. People aren't just going to give you things, though. The last name will open doors. It's what you do with those opportunities is how you're going to be judged in the future. And sure enough, I'm not going to lie to you. Oh, picking up the phone and talking to contacts that my dad has known for 40 years in the game of baseball helps open the door. It helps break the ice. But it's what you have and the substance that you bring to the table within that conversation and how you sell yourself and position yourself with the experience that allow you to succeed and get to bigger and better things. And without question, it's helped me, but I think I've made the most of my opportunities. And once I got in the door, I really took hold of my own person, my own persona, and I think I've made the most of it.
It's interesting, you worked for the Newark Bears. I didn't know that when I was preparing for this interview, and we recently had Frank Bolton, the CEO of the Ducks and the league on, and talking about that league. And I mean, I didn't know you were the assistant GM, also announcer, and names like Kinsenko and Leiritz were on the roster when you're there. Now, Newark has had problems, and they're trying to make a comeback, so knowing the history of baseball in Newark, that might have been, I would think, that's a pretty good experience for you.
I had a lot of experience with Frank Bolton, the Long Island Ducks, and he also owned the
Bridgeport.
The Surf at the time,
yeah.
When I was there. He owned the Surf in Atlantic City as well as the Long Island. It was an interesting experience, and, the way I tell the story is this is how it happened. Rick Cerrone hired me to be the assistant general manager to put the team together, and, oh, by the way, you can do some color on our radio broadcast. So I was charged with, I'm the guy that signed, I had signed Jamie Navarro and Jack Armstrong to begin with. Then I signed the Kinsenko brothers, Lance Johnson, Jimmy Leiritz, and then it progressed on to bigger names as well, Mark Leiters in the world and Ryan Miners. But anyways, about a month and a half after I got to Newark, before the season even started, our play-by-play guy quit. He went on to work for the indoor lacrosse team. So I took over play-by-play. I've never done broadcasting at all. I mean, I went to radio broadcasting school, like to splice tape and DJ.
Wow.
I didn't go to, the only play-by-play I knew was listening to Denny Matthews calling Royals baseball. That was it.
Wow.
So I became the play-by-play guy, and boy, I tell you what, those tapes, I still have them, are brutal.
Is there anywhere on eBay we could get those? Because I think they'd be worthwhile these days, right?
Absolutely no chance you get your hands on those tapes. But about a month and a half into the season, our GM got fired, and Rick wanted me to take over. So for the better part of 2000 and, first part of 2001, I was the, 01 and 02, I was the play-by-play guy and general manager of the Newark Bears.
Wow.
And it got to the point, especially in 02, when I got hooked up with MLB.com and I started doing a morning show when they started streaming radio shows, that the schedule to be able to do the business side of things with Rick, who's very a very good business mind, it was too much. So I peeled off the GM title and I stayed as play-by-play doing the MLB.com stuff. And then, that offseason, that following January is when the Diamondbacks called. So That's how that whole thing transpired. And I had a blast in Newark. We lived in downtown Newark. People still shake their heads. They can't believe that we did that. But it was fun. It was a great experience. I loved working for Rick. Would I do it again? If I had to, I would. You know, those are the things that you have to do when you're getting into the game late and it's an opportunity that presents itself. You wrap your arms around it and say, all right, if I'm going to do this, this is the way it's going to be. You know, not everything's going to be handed to you on a silver platter, and it wasn't, and I made the most of it.
And that 93 Marlins team that you coached for, you know, that was my – I wasn't old enough to remember the 77 expansion, but 93 expansion, Colorado, Florida, you go back into the encyclopedia, you look at that roster, bad year for that team, but there was a ton of talent already coming up. I mean, you were around that. You look back, that's a pretty unique experience being part of an expansion team.
It was awesome. It really was. And there were some guys there that were – you know, incredible, from Brian Harvey to Charlie Huff to Benito Santiago to Dave Magadan, Jeff Conine. I mean, it was an absolute blast. And then, we also had Trevor Hoffman, who ended up getting traded to San Diego for Gary Sheffield, and Gary was a great guy. And then we also had Rob Ned, who came over from Texas in the Rob Carpenter deal. So it was a pretty cool experience to be a part of it. And for me, it was the best part about it was the fact that my dad was in uniform.
Yep.
He was the third base coach, and that was extremely cool to see two Rojases together and had a blast. And I met a great guy in Beta Pinson, who, God rest his soul, just one of the sweetest men I've ever met in my life. And I got a chance to sit with him next to him on the charter every single place we went, and just the conversations we had. Those are things that you just can't take away from, that you never lose sight of. And focus of, because those are memories that, just like the ones I shared with you about my dad, those are those few moments in life that you just have to take a snapshot of and be able to reflect on, you know, any number of times when things are going bad, how good those times were when you meet good people.
You mentioned you broadcast for Arizona and Texas and MLB. You know, I had Kurt Smith on. We were talking about Vin Scully last month, and I said, you know what, what do you think Scully's signature call was? And Gary Cohen has talked about that. Now, I know that you're a lot, you know, younger than those guys in broadcasting, but at this point in your career, if someone says, Victor, what's your signature moment in the booth? Do you have one that you could maybe share with us?
Signature moment in the booth. Let's see. I'd have to say, at least right now, it's Sammy Sosa's 600th home run. I had that call. And it's significant to me because at the time, Sammy, it was his 1 year with Texas, and he was really a nice guy to me. And you root for milestones, and things come out after the fact. And I think it's up to every individual to kind of to pass judgment if they so choose. But I go back to that moment, and I remember being in Cincinnati, and prior to coming home to Texas, and I remember telling my partner Eric Nadell, who'd been there 30 years, "Hey man, when Sammy, he was at 599. I had a chance to call 598-99 in Cincinnati, and I said, hey, when he comes up from now on, I would really like for you to have the call. I'd like to turn over the at bat for you, because I mean you're the icon of Texas Rangers baseball. What do I? I'm just a schlep calling my third year Ranger baseball, fourth year in the big leagues. I think you should have that call." And he said, "Absolutely not, man. Let's let it play out the way it plays out, and wherever it falls, it falls." And sure enough, we had the Cubs at the ballpark in Arlington. Jason Marquis, who was wearing Sammy Sosa's old number 21, was on the mound facing Sosa. And I remember the call vividly. Shout out to right center field. My family and my friends were up from Houston. They were at the ball game. And I remember making the call, standing up, throwing my hands up, and I immediately look at them, and I point to them, and they were pointing back at me. It was pretty cool, just considering the situation, how that stadium erupted and how things played out, and the irony behind number 21 on the mound facing the former number 21 of that team. It was pretty cool.
Hey, you're with the MLB Network now, and I'd be remiss if I didn't tell you what a great job you guys are doing. You got a lot of lefties in that that broadcast, Williams, Leiter, Plesek, but I really like how you guys have got interactive. In the off season, you had some players in, talking about the fundamentals, how to run the bases. You did a great job on the trading deadline. You know, there was a lot of skepticism when a league takes over a network, is it going to be propaganda? But I think you guys, and the feedback, I'm sure, not just what I'm giving you, you've gotten from other people, the feedback has been that you guys are kind of setting the standard for the other leagues and how to go and give information to the fans.
Well, without question, and I think that's the thing that Major League Baseball Network did the best. Because I mean, even when I was at .com, you know, in 01, 02, I kept sitting there going, "When's this beta?" The buzz was there. When's baseball going to launch its network? I mean, come on, what's going on? I want to be a part of that. And I think the best part, the best thing that they did was that they waited. They saw the other networks and what worked, what didn't work. Distribution being, of course, the biggest part of it. And that Major League Baseball was ever to, that was able to strike a deal with DirecTV as well as the consortium of cable providers around the country and be able to launch a network to 50 million people. That just tells you that they did the right thing. And they hired Tony Petitti as the CEO coming over from CBS Sports. And what he has done is surrounded himself from the technical side, from production side, with just great people. It didn't matter the background. MSG, SNY, Fox, ESPN, it doesn't matter where you were from. He's brought everybody together, whether it's from behind the scenes or on the, in front of the camera, and basically said, you know what, let's write this book. There is no right or wrong way to do things. Let's figure it out. And the book, as this season progresses, is still being written. You know, for me, I got hired December 10th. I flew up on December 28th. Or 27th, and on the 28th, I was sitting in an office looking at a rundown. I had no idea what I was doing. I was going to be a part of this network launch 4 days from now. And it was amazing to me. It might as well have been in Japanese because I had no idea what I was doing. I'd never done TV before other than TV games, but I'd never sat behind of a desk or what camera to look at or read prompter or write scripts. Never done that. And that's the kind of mentality that Tony and John Entsch have taken is, you know, hire guys that they have promise and they see something in, and the other stuff will work itself out. And I think for the most part, it really has. And I think the network's done a tremendous job, especially from an analyst standpoint. The guys that they hired, top notch, man. I mean, yeah. From instruction, from personality. I mean, it's a varied mix, experience wise as well. And I think they just keep doing a terrific job with the guys they bring in.
Yeah, and before I let you go, I know you're on Twitter and you have your own blog and MLB blogs. Anything you want to let the listeners know about that you have coming up?
No, nothing really. I usually, whatever pops into my mind, as you well know by following on Twitter, I go ahead and say it. And if it's baseball related, I like to talk about it. And you know, for the most part, I was skeptical. We wrote that thing for Business of Baseball, or the thebusinessofbaseball.com, about social networking. I was fearful about it because I didn't want to be that guy and say, oh, I'm going to bed now or anything like that. I just thought that to me is a waste of time. But I've grown to love it just from the information that flows so frequently on those things. I'm constantly checking forget about email. I keep checking my Twitter just to see what the posts are of the information of baseball that's out there. And I love the fact that there are so many people that want to talk baseball, ask questions, and almost become friends via Twitter and Facebook.
Well, Victor, listen, I appreciate the time. You've been very generous with it. Keep up the good work at the MLB Network. We'll be following you on Twitter. We'll talk again.
Thanks, buddy. I really appreciate it.
All right. Take care, Victor.
That's Victor Rojas. Check him out at thespoils.mlbblogs.com and at Twitter at VictorRojas29. We're out of time. But you can listen to the replay of this show or any show at nybaseballdigest.com. I want to thank Adam behind the glass, buddy Anthony behind the computer, and our buddy Joe Gucciardo at behind the camera over there. I'd like to thank Mark Costello. Check out SaveTheYankeeGate2.com and Victor Rojas of the MLB Network. I want to thank Blog Talk Radio and 1240 AM WGBB. And remember to tune in for the best features, interviews, opinions, and analysis on New York baseball at nybaseballdigest.com. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your night.